Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle.
Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la,
puddle.
Sha-la-la-la,
sha-la-la-la, puddle. Dip, 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 dip,
Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. The subject of tonight's program is organized labor, unions, and workers in the Trump administration. And this is a part two from a show we did last February, 2018. And with us, again, very special guest, Dr. Ray Hoegler, labor law professor emeritus and professor of management emeritus, Colorado State University, Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Law, University of Tuscia, Italy. Ray, thank you again for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU.
Thank you for the invite, Dennis.
Ray, let's begin just some brief background update, and let me say congratulations. For this KGNU listening audience, could you share your impressive academic journey starting from your days as an undergraduate at CU Boulder to your recent retirement at Colorado State University this past semester?
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. I've been very fortunate. It's all public education, and I have to say, without opportunities like this, my life would have been a lot different because I was born and raised in Durango, Colorado, which, if you know, is a very small place. And I went to Fort Lewis College there, and I was able to graduate with an undergraduate degree. I was fortunate. I got a public fellowship, a Woodrow Wilson fellowship. I was able to go to Emory University. I studied English there, came back to the University of Colorado, and got a PhD degree in English, and also had federal government funding for that. After that, I turned to law and went to law school at the University of Colorado and graduated from there. Then I went to work for a private sector employer, Mountain States Employers Council, down in Denver, where I got some excellent training on the employer side of labor relations. I went back to work for the Center of Labor Education at CU, and I was fortunate to work under two excellent labor arbitrators and labor specialists. After that, I went to work at Pennsylvania State University in the Department of Labor Education, which focused on labor. While I was there, incidentally, Penn State won two national championships, and I was there for that, and quite an experience. Then I came to Colorado State University in 1988. I also had the opportunity to be a Fulbright Distinguished Chair of Labor Law at the University of Tuscia in Italy, Viterbo, Italy, in 2007. And I finally retired in 2018, and they give us this title of Professor Emeritus if you retire from a particular institution. So that's my status now. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. And I can see all these years I've been saying Tuscia instead of Tuscia. So I apologize. Ray,
but all right.
And one other thing I'll just add for the listening audience. You are one of about 25, no more than 30 people that have ran in every single Boulder. So, you know, you're not no one-trick pony. You do a lot of other stuff, too.
No. We had the 40th this year, and there were about 60 men and I think 30 women who've run all 40. So they gave us a nice T-shirt signifying that. I was really happy to be able to do it.
All right, then, Ray, let's get into the content of the show. Organized labor in the Trump administration. Let's begin with the National Labor Relations Board, also known as the NLRB. Could you discuss update President of the United States Trump's appointments to the National Labor Relations Board? And as before, can you explain some of the adverse consequences that are already apparent in recent NLRB decisions?
Yeah, the NLRB is the government agency that oversees and has first opportunity to decide labor issues, and they're very important. I mean, this is one of the basic fundamental agencies that deal with workers' rights in the United States. There's supposed to be five members. I went on the board's website just a few minutes ago and double-checked, and it shows only four. Normally speaking, the president of the United States has the opportunity to appoint, depending on whether he has one or two terms, to appoint members to the board. So it's referred to as the Obama board or the Trump board or whichever president appoints them. And they make decisions, I think, which are fairly consistent with the prevailing political direction and who's appointed them. But I should add, they're also tend to be very professional, and they're constrained by past decisions to a fair extent. They don't have to be bound by them necessarily, but they do take that into consideration. So the situation now is that the Republicans dominate the board. One of the prime liberal members is a woman named Lauren McFerrin, and she very often dissents in cases. But the board has the first shot at important labor questions.
All right, then, Ray. Let's move on, then. We got a lot on the plate. The Supreme Court. Early on in President of the United States Trump's role as president, he was successful in getting Neil Gorsuch nominated and approved by the U.S. Senate to replace deceased Antonio Scalia. This past year, 2018, the same process took place as Brett Kavanaugh replaced retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. How will their respective legal backgrounds and very conservative postures impact the U.S. labor movement?
I think in very important ways. These labor cases are often decided by a split court. They're often decided by one or two votes, in fact. One of the best examples, we've already talked about it, is this Janus decision, which prohibited public sector unions from extracting what they call compulsory dues payments on First Amendment grounds. These are the kind of cases, and by the way, Janus, the decision overruled many years of precedent, over four decades of precedent. This is a kind of example of how the Supreme Court can shape important labor rules and do so on a constitutional basis, which is a problem, because if you say, well, this is a constitutional right not to have to pay union dues, then there's no kind of legislation that can force you to do that. That's the problem with the Supreme Court. Once they render decisions like that, it effectively precludes a lot of legislative activity. Kavanaugh, you could say, who knows? I mean, there's a pretense that these guys are impartial. I don't think they're impartial at all. You could look at Neil Gorsuch's record. You can see that he falls right into line with that conservative tradition, just like his mother, Ann Gorsuch. I mean, she was a member of Reagan's cabinet, and she was a very influential Republican politician. I think he favors that line of thinking. And maybe people who think about this a little bit say, yes, that's exactly the way it should be. Because we are so divided, let a president who gets elected pick the justices he wants. It's problematic, though, in that it does tilt the court. These guys are life appointments, and they'll be around for a long time.
In that case, you're referring to Janus. That was Janus versus AFSCME. And like you said, once that decision was made against AFSCME, that becomes settled law. And are you aware of any pending cases to be heard, union-wise?
Yeah, I think this is not exactly a union case, but one of the true issues, I think, of our time is whether or not employers, in the context of workplace rules, whether an employer can force an employee to go to arbitration rather than take a case to a court or the NLRB. This is, interestingly enough, I mean, this is the Stormy Daniels versus Trump case, because Trump is a master of trying to conceal what he's doing by forcing people to arbitrate disputes rather than go to a public hearing. And that's the whole deal with Cohen and Stormy Daniels and all this business. So the issue is, can you force somebody to go to arbitration and keep it private, have it decided by a private individual rather than a court? The Supreme Court has basically upheld that right. And they're now, I think, making law that's going to allow employers to force more and more cases into arbitration. So if you have an arbitration clause and you think you've been discriminated against on the basis of race or gender, you may have to arbitrate that case rather than go to court. And that is what Stormy Daniels was about. So this is something that's still in the works, and I think it's going to be resolved probably in favor of arbitration.
Thank you, Ray. Ray, let's move on to this very important subject, wage growth. Could you give an update on lagging wage growth for all workers and their families, especially union workers here in the state of Colorado and throughout the United States? And why is this a serious problem for all workers trying very hard every day to meet their basic needs of food, clothing, housing, medical needs, so on and so forth?
Well, I think it's basically the reason that Trump got elected. As I see it, here's the difficulty. Unions began to decline in the late 1960s and through the 1970s. There was a period of time when workers in this country had sufficiently strong unions to be able to bargain for advances in real wages. That turned around right at the end of the 1970s. The result was a period of time dominated by very conservative thinking and conservative politics. That would be the era of Ronald Reagan. And at that point, employers in the United States really began to disregard or discount or radically challenge collective bargaining. It's fairly simple in my view. As unions decline, real wages decline for American workers. Once that decline sets in and continues through, really, through the 1990s, with rare exceptions and into the period of time we are now, once that bites down and happens, and it's hard to reverse. So there are many economists now who are talking about the fact, well, we have full employment, we have adequate inflation is under control, what's the problem? And then they continue on with the thought, why aren't real wages increasing? And they may be at this point in time. There's some indication they are. But over the past, I would say, four decades, that hasn't been the case. And real wages and real economic disparity, if you will, because if there is increases in income, it's in the higher bracket. That's what produced Trump. And I think Trump's actions since he's taken a White House don't show any real regard for the people who got him there. I mean, it's arguable he has policies. On the other hand, I don't think he takes into consideration sufficiently what the real problem is.
All right, then, Ray, I'm just going to maybe review and continue, you know, what you've just said and everything in the context of, you know, the next one thing I want to address is income inequality, and you've talked about a little bit. And as you said, unions were a major force for economic equality in this country from 1947 to 1978. Since that time, 1979 to 2019, unions declined and subsequently led to our present situation of quote-unquote massive income inequality. You know, as per our previous interviews, and you mentioned a few things, could you present some reasons, economic and political, for the decline of unions during this time frame? And as the previous question I asked, how has all of this had a negative impact on wage growth?
I think it's fairly well connected that declines in unionism lead to declines in wage growth for a segment of the population that is the working class, if you will, of the United States. It's very interesting. People and the decline of unions, I think many people attribute that to the fact that employers have opposed unions over, they've done such a great job that unions are not a very significant factor. Union density has remained fairly stable. It's right around 10%, but 10% is not enough to have a real impact on labor markets anymore. And I think many economists say, well, sure, the fact that we don't have a vigorous and robust system of collective bargaining leads to declining wages for what basically used to be the middle class of America. Then there are other explanations. I mean, some people say, well, it's the decline in manufacturing. It's these other competitive factors from China and other places like that. That may be true, but other countries managed to hang on to a better distribution of income and a relatively more secure safety net. In the United States, we've shredded a lot of that. There's not much real wage growth. Markets failed to produce real wage growth, as many economists predicted they would. And I think the result is a lot of dissatisfaction out there, which leads to political turmoil.
Yeah, I read the last, I'm on the mailing list for the U.S. Department of Labor, and I read the last report, and of course they were all pumped up that wage growth for workers was, in December or perhaps for 2018 was 3.2%, and it was above this, that, and whatever. But, you know, I think the all-time real inflation rate for the year was like 2.9%. So, you know, you're walking forward like 0.4%. You're not gonna, and you're not making much progress, you know.
That's exactly right.
Ray, with that, you know, I think what we need to talk about, and, you know, I know you want to talk about the Trump tax cuts. So how has the tax cuts implemented by President of the United States, Trump, disproportionately benefited the wealthy? And what is and what will be the impact on the middle class in the context of sustained prosperity?
This is very interesting. He ran on a platform of tax cuts. He thought there was too much taxation in this country. So he implemented a series of tax cuts, he and Congress did. And those tax cuts, I think, were primarily beneficial to higher income groups. I've seen data that indicate that there is no real tax cut benefit for many Americans, particularly in the lower income cohorts. Primarily, those tax cuts benefited people who were already well off. The problem is, as I see it, one of the issues that Republicans have continued to talk about over and over and over again is the deficit. And the truth is, I believe the accurate statement is that Trump's tax cuts are going to have a tremendously negative effect, adverse effect on the deficit. So we're just passing this on to the next generation to try to deal with. And this belief or whatever it is, this economic argument about we have to be careful about increasing deficits seems now to go nowhere. I don't think any congressman from the Republicans has indicated that it's a real problem in their eyes. So if we continue to expand the deficit and give taxes back, their theory is, well, that's going to result in more economic growth. And that argument has been made, but I think it's been disproved. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, just put out a little graph or distributed a little graph that shows that higher taxes have not, in fact, dampened economic growth during periods of high taxation on higher incomes. We've done quite well. You may know Ocasio-Cortez, the new freshman senator who's quite controversial, made that same argument. And she was attacked vigorously, but people like Krugman and other eminent economists have come to her defense. And they pointed out, historically in this country, high tax rates have not necessarily dampened economic growth. In fact, high tax rates and robust economic growth seem to have gone together for many years in this country. So I don't think this tax cut thing is going to help too many people at the lower end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I think that she's definitely going to be a great voice representing her constituency in Queens, New York as a U.S. Congresswoman. But Ray, one thing just to finish up this part. I've been reading, like, with all this, you know, the wealth that was given away with this tax things, instead of the job creation, I read more and more that some of these corporations are just doing stock buybacks and actually, you know, increasing their wealth even more. Any comments there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it makes perfect sense if you're a corporation and you say, well, we've got this money and what should we do with it? And you say, well, we should expand, we should start to grow our business, we should do this, we should do that. I think they look around at the competitive environment and say, well, maybe what we ought to do is to increase our stock price and our or expansion of shareholders, what we ought to do is not necessarily to go into more business or try to take on competitors if we know we're not going to be able to do well against. So we'll just buy back our shares, and that's going to increase the price of our stock, and that makes our company more valuable, and it makes our shareholders happy. Now, if you're somebody who's invested in that kind of activity, most of us are not, except for pension funds, then that's good. But if you're not one of those players, then it doesn't do you a lot of good.
All right, Ray, I got a couple, we're moving on pretty good here. A couple political issues, that's one category I have here, and I have a couple questions, one more in the federal level and one more in the state. So let's begin with this. Democrats regained majority control of the U.S. House of Representatives. In spite of this, how will Trump's judicial and administrative appointees guarantee an anti-union climate for the immediate future, even if he's impeached or defeated in 2020?
Yes, and the problem is he's had the opportunity to appoint any number of federal judges. I personally believe that most members of the judiciary would claim, like Justice John Roberts, to be impartial and to try to make decisions based on the law. The argument against that kind of thinking is to say these people may have a certain philosophy which tilts the way they look at things, and the law is never impartial. You have a whole range of options when you're looking at judicial decisions, which ones you want to support. That's the difficulty. Embedding this number of federal appointees under Trump, and I don't think Donald Trump has either the knowledge or the interest or the wherewithal to go through and to single out which judges are going to be of a political persuasion. But those people who have Trump's ear, like the Federalist Society, they're in there making up their list of appointees, and basically Trump is saying, okay, fine, whatever you guys want. So the federal judiciary is going to remain, I think, tilted to the right for a long, long, long time.
Ray, let's get into state legislatures. And we have good news. Colorado, Democrats now control the governorship and the state house and the state senate. But how does this compare with the other 49 states? And beyond that, could you explain the difficulty of the Colorado legislature or any other state to undo the Trump Republican legacy in the immediate future?
Yeah, and it is a difficulty. We have a system of governance in this country in which the primary power is ceded to the federal government. They have supremacy over any conflicting laws. As we've interpreted the Constitution, that federal power is very pervasive and extends everywhere. So you run into issues of shared governance. The state can do certain things like set the minimum wage. We can have decent labor standards if we want to. And other states can do that as well. However, there is a very influential body at work in the state. These people, well, I'll just back up a minute. In my opinion, what really controls the labor environment as far as unions and states is right-to-work laws. They now have a majority of states in the United States. What that indicates to me is a conservative philosophy about labor and labor rights. So I think state governments are tremendously important. They do things in some states like expand minimum wage. They do other beneficial things to protect workers. But at some point, they run up against the federal preemptive power. So there's only a limited number of things states can do. And I believe that there's a very strong impetus for conservative forces when they do run up against the state law that they think exceeds what ought to be done to protect workers' rights. They'll bring lawsuits, and I see that happening over and over and over again. I mean, there are conservative groups out there like the Federalist Society and other conservative judicial bodies or legal entities, which that's what their job is, to bring lawsuits to try to curb excessive state activism, if you will.
All right, then, Ray, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to ask this question. It might be part of the summary for you, but we'll see how this goes, you know, within this 3 minutes. Is it President of the United States Trump was elected by a massive turnout and support by non-college educated white workers and from states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, my home state, which I didn't think was going to go for Trump, but it did. And there was other states as well. These non-college educated white workers, they were very angry with their economic status. For the 2020 election, what could change their mindset? Because Trump still has a 41 to 42% support rate with this weight, with this base. And as far as I'm concerned, that is a large number. Your comments?
Well, I agree. It is a large number. And I think Trump demonstrates that every day by doing things that his, quote, base wants in opposition to whatever anybody else wants. The problem with the Democrats, as commentators point out over and over and over again, they're not very well organized. They don't necessarily have a candidate to single out and put forward. Hillary, for reasons that are still under review and under investigation, lost the election, even though she carried a popular vote. So the question is, what tilted those, I think, crucial working class votes in places like Wisconsin and Michigan? I think the answer was deep dissatisfaction, partly because of union decline. Those people were traditional union members. They supported unions. They made a very good wage. As all that begins to turn around and their circumstances change, they start to switch to somebody like Trump, who says, hey, I'll make America, you know, I'm going to put on my hat. I'll make America great again. What he promised was to return to manufacturing in the good 1960s and 1970s. He was unable to do that, but now it's too late.
Ray, we have about, 45 seconds. So do you have any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience in the context of this evening's subject, organized labor in the Trump administration, part two?
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I saw some data that said millennials are the ones who really now support being organized. They don't necessarily say labor unions, but they support being organized. So it's interesting to watch what may be coming down the road. Millennials don't have the votes to overturn everything yet and to take a different direction, but they might. And it's going to be interesting to see what the 2020 election looks like in that regard.
All right, then, Ray, thank you again for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. And for those of you who have joined us late, the subject of tonight's program was Organized Labor in the Trump Administration, Part 2. And with us was Dr. Ray Hoegler, Labor Law Professor Emeritus and Professor of Management Emeritus, Colorado State University, and Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Law from University of Tuscia, Italy. If you have any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, January 14, 2019, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been the Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio.
Sha-la-la-la, 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 sha-la-la-la.